still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.
All right, here we are with Exalted, Princes of the Universe.
Off topic.
Another off topic. This one is regarding the schemes of the Wanmei Deliberative in their first age incarnations. I'm Devin, and with me I have...
Peter.
All right, so... This has been brought up a couple of times in the game. It first showed up in Season 1, actually, which, as we know, wasn't recorded. But the Wanmei Deliberative has been a circle of solars forever. They've always exalted near each other and gotten together. They've been each other's siblings and rivals, and they've always been heavily interconnected. To the point of, that's probably why none of them have a lunar soulmate. They've always had each other, and for better or for worse, been stuck with each other. In this large amount of time, it's been... found out that the Wanmei Deliberative was largely considered to be outsiders or troublemakers in solar deliberative society. They were often at the edge and often kind of at the periphery, you know, outside of view, doing their own thing, being kind of shitty.
Well, I think you mentioned that we're sort of more focused on creation rather than doing others.
Yeah, the first age was a realm of wonder and stuff that goes beyond, you know, like the minds of man, you know, where the solars were like erecting fantastic universes and like places that you could go in spirit while you slept, or creating works of sorcery that fundamentally altered the laws of physics and changed how the landscape was. Whereas the Wanmei Deliberative, they dealt with physical stuff. They dealt with the physicality of mortals, usually. They're the ones who pumped up the biggest cults for themselves and, you know, dealt with mortal kind directly. They often didn't use lunars, or they often didn't have a lot of dragon-blooded as their, like, servants or shit. Maybe they'd have, like, a sidereal assigned to them, but usually they just did it on their own and liked to stay away from all that stuff. They weren't at the calibration feast where the usurpation happened. They don't go to those. They stay and do their own thing.
That's interesting.
Yeah. So, specifically, we're going to talk about the Immortality Project so that people have a single place to kind of listen to them and get ideas about what they're all about. Every one of the Wanmei Deliberative Solars had a project for living forever, living well past the death of their current incarnations. And they would work on these projects, you know, from incarnation to incarnation to perfect it and make it better. And these projects were pretty fucking crazy. So... I guess I'll go down the list from Dawn all the way down to Eclipse.
Oh, go for it.
All right. So, the Dawncast, the Wanderer. His method of immortality, such as it is, was to create a world where he wouldn't have to reincarnate or worry about what kind of person he'd be in his next life, because everyone that his exaltation would go towards, like every warrior or every person that would be, you know, a Dawncast, would be someone that he'd want to exalt as. To do this, he worked on the concept of language and the concept of how learning a language or playing a game or learning a skill alters the way you think and the way your personality is. And he pushed this idea into the form of combat, in the form of battle and war and organization. So the Wanderer's grand scheme was now in the Age of Sorrows, you know, in the Age of the Realm, anyone who knows martial arts... melee, war, dodge, any sort of trained combat skill or who is versed in battle tactics, they learned that from the original tiger warrior training that the Wanderer invented in the First Age. Because he dealt with mortals. So his shtick was to teach mortals en masse his perfect martial art, his perfect battle styles, his perfect theories on war and fighting. And those styles were so mimetic and so viral. That and so easy to learn, and such a fundamental part of reality that everyone picked them up. All mortals did. And those mortals eventually became exalts, and they eventually perfected this training and taught it to other people. And it just kept going and going because the Wanderer was wise enough in the First Age to make sure that every mortal would be able to pick this up. Before, you know, there was no unification of battle tactics. There was no single form of combat or easy step-by-step instructions on how to make yourself, say, even make yourself stronger to work out. He put it all together first, and he made it best. So, by dint of you picking up a sword and learning how to be a swordsman, or learning how to fight in a group, or learning how to work out and make yourself stronger and healthier and building muscle mass, by dint of learning how to, you know, suffer with armor on and get more endurance up, or how to swim while you're carrying full gear. All of these things manipulate how you think about yourselves and how you see the world. And all of these small manipulations add up so that by the time you've actually learned the Tiger Warrior training, and I don't mean the charm, I mean this is what it was called, by the time you've mastered being a Tiger Warrior, you think basically exactly like the Wanderer would. You react like he would. You have the values he would of honor and dueling and swordsmanship. And it all sticks in the back of your mind. And so if the Wanderer ever died in one of his incarnations, the next Dawncast that would rise up would already know all his, the basics of all his battle tactics, and would already think like he would. I would already be a and be strong and healthy and exercised and educated in war. He wouldn't have to start from scratch, and all of his memories would basically be much more accessible because the person he exalted into would be very much like him. His ultimate victory wasn't having to be the Wanderer, the Soler, that would live forever. It would be that every person to pick up a sword or a fist to fight would be the Wanderer. Now, time's gone by, and all that training's basically, you know, fallen apart and been changed and made worse, and inefficiencies have shown up, and language has broken down, basically. So the Tiger Warrior techniques are just, you know, swordsmanship. How to use a flame piece. How to wear armor. You know, all the little individual skills and exalted about combat are fragmentations of the perfect Tiger Warrior, his incarnation that mastered this stuff. So they don't think like the Wanderer anymore. They just think like a soldier, but it's all still there. Every single person in creation who picks up a weapon is like the Wanderer in some way in his first age incarnation. And if the Wanderer were to work to reestablish the Tiger Warrior method, the way, the perfect way to be a soldier and a warrior, then it would spread like wildfire through creation again. And the next time he exalted, he'd basically be a person who thought and acted just like himself. Immortality.
Yeah. So I think the Wanderer didn't progress much in reestablishing this style.
Not really. The Wanderer understands in-game a bit about how it's supposed to work, but he hasn't really focused on the potential of it. I think circumstances and events have basically pulled him away from really looking.
And was all introduced in the first season, or was it also reintroduced or elaborated upon?
It's been building slowly. Like, I think I introduced it fully in the first season out of character, and it's been building. This idea that it was a viral language of war that made everyone like her, that made him immortal. It was a really interesting way to make immortality something that wasn't just, you know, he's a lich, lol, or he bound his soul into a sword, you know. It was a nice way to make the Dawncast actually seem pragmatic and wise and intelligent about how he'd be immortal. Because what do drill sergeants do in the army? What is the point of the U.S. or of any country's military but to tear down the individual and build one giant organism that acts immediately to the needs of the army itself? Yeah. So it's that idea taken, you know, what would the perfect combination of Patton and that Nazi general, Roosevelt? Damn it. I had his name. I forgot it. If you watch Danger 5, listeners, it was the Nazi general that made the gold tanks. I don't remember his name. Rommel!
Okay.
Motherfucking Rommel, yeah. What would a perfect general do for immortality? And I thought this was an intelligent answer, something that a wise, conquering madman would invent.
It sounds interesting. And
it also gives the Wanderer ownership of a part of the setting. You know, this fact that his character invented modern combat.
Yep.
Or modern, you know, exercise or all of that stuff. That's perfect. That's cool.
So does that mean that the Wanderer will also be changing himself the more he progresses in his own training? That the player should start acting like his first age corrupted Sola that thinks about himself?
I mean, doesn't he already? Doesn't he act a little bit like this Tiger Warrior, this soldier that uses violence as the first solution to every problem?
I don't know. He doesn't seem like the first age Sola all that much, but
he's not there, but he hasn't even tried.
Yeah.
Like I said, that first age Sola's plan fell apart because Tiger Warrior training isn't around anymore. You know, it's just not a thing. And listeners who are pedantic, we're not talking about the goddamn charm. The charm in this is named after the Soler that the Wanderer was in the first age. The Wanderer came first.
Okay.
All right. I'm just going to pause. So, next in line is the Zenith, Killer Queen. So, we've discussed this a lot, and it's a little more conventional as far as immortality goes. In the first age, the Killer Queen's exalt, our incarnation, their tactic for being immortal was to ensure that the type of person who would have the grandeur and potential to become their next incarnation would be very carefully groomed and kept close at hand. To this end, the Zenith was using breeding programs and genealogy and genetic engineering, making children, much like the Killer Queen does now, hilariously enough, with Neoma and her own circle mates and her children and her parents and her siblings and her rivals, mixing them up, creating huge family trees from these individuals and then making sure they mix up later on and keep intermingling and stuff and getting diversity from other powerful beings. Pushing the line so there'd be hundreds, if not thousands, of people that descended from, you know, that incarnation and other incarnations that would come later and ones that came before, always seeking out backwards and forwards along the incarnation line and adding more and more of them to this diverse web of this huge spider's web of a family tree that kept overlapping itself so that odds are someone who would be like the Zenith, someone who would have that same kind of fanaticism and hunger for order and desire for zealotry would also be within this web and would also have all those the abilities that would come with, you know, being so interbred with supernaturalness. You know, your next incarnation is the child of, like, the Dawncast, or is, like, the brother of the next Zenith, or, you know, ends up marrying the next circle mate that comes up. Like, it just kept going over and over and getting more concentrated. There's not really inbreeding in creation.
Yeah.
And introducing supernatural and demonic lines was the way to go.
So, you could have half demon offspring or half god offspring. Can they exalt as well?
Oh, yeah, totally. God-blooded? They're called god-blooded. It's a catch-all term.
Yeah.
You bet they can exalt.
Mm-hmm. Well, definitely sounds like an interesting plan to boss up your strength.
It was a little more intense than just being like, oh, now I have god-blooded children. It was casting this wide net all the way that went all the way back to before the Primordial War. And finding all these people who could have possibly been related to the circle. Like, every one of the five of them's incarnations, and every family member they had, and every descendant they had, and reaching out and finding them always, and bringing them in, and, like, you know, using neomas and necromancy, when that later became an option, to, like, dig them up as ghost-blooded, and bring their bodies back, and find their bones in charnel houses and tombs, and, like, using those bones with neoma to make new children. Think of it. Every incarnation that the circle ever had, every family member they ever had, every sibling they ever had, every child they ever had, going back and forth across all their bloodlines, being gathered up and turned into new genetic material and new children and new people that were then, like, you know, kept trained in martial arts, trained in sorcery, you know, taught to be taught in all things about the world and stuff, and put in charge of important parts of the empire the Zenith would run from incarnation to incarnation, and all of them intermingling with other spirits and stuff that were loyal over and over and over.
Yeah, it's also a bit like the Empress and her...
The Empress was more about purifying the Dragon-blooded bloodline and making careful choices. The Zenith was more about going as far as possible, like extending that reach as far as it could go to ensure that the next time the Zenith exalted, it would be within this family. And this family, you know, would have this huge support network of millions. And, you know, documenting it too in, like, a complex three-dimensional mandala that shows where everyone was related to and where they showed up and how they interconnect and stuff and what exaltations multiple that they have relation to. A sort of web of family to trap the exaltation in, so that once it was there, it was never going away again. And it worked. For the most part, that fucking worked. And when it didn't, she would just be like, oh, well, I exalted into this family now. When she started getting the memories back and started to, like, really explore the project, inevitably the family would seek that person out and be like, no, you gotta be part of the family now. And you know, the mortal or even, like, the demon-blooded members of this web would seek out Neoma, seek out this new incarnation's family lines, going backwards and forwards and sideways, and bring it in and stuff.
Mm.
You know, working in the background.
So that'd also be affecting the other circular members? Would they also be reincarnated in the same family?
Maybe, who can say? But for the Zenith, and it being this huge social project that spanned the entire world and time and the underworld and the wild and heaven, it definitely worked for the Zenith. It was a solid project, always having a family.
So, how has the Killer Queen progressed so far?
She immediately fell back into it the second she had the opportunity to do so.
as famously noted in the season 2 opener, season 2 ender, with the baby. Remember the baby, guys? It was a child made from all five of them, including the dead one whose skull they dug up and turned into a cup. And then they used like Neoma and Celestial Wine to sanctify it. And now that kid, you know, Madrono, I think his name is like in his 30s now, or in his mid to late 20s.
Yeah, I think 20s would be.
And all the other children have been made now from other circles, like the Abyssals and the Infernals and stuff, and the Alchemicals.
Yeah.
And yeah, there they are, the Koopalings, hanging out. It's all started up again.
Yeah, I wonder what happens if some of the circle mates die and decide, hey, Claire Queen, I want to exalt your kid. Will he hate me for that?
Right?
Yeah, that would be interesting thing to see.
It would be interesting.
When it happens. When.
Right? Jesus H. Christ.
Yeah.
So, that brings us to the Twilight then. Yeah. The Majestic. Now, the Majestic was the original Immortality project. The Majestic was the one that started first. It started earliest. So, the Majestic's project, which started in his first incarnation, the Primordial War era, was to always be alive, always living, never dying. And they started with what they learned from the Primordial War, you know, living in caves, living in the savage world of creation before technology existed, building and designing things and setting up future research for future incarnations. And yeah, every incarnation would pick up the slack. So the first version of this project was a phylactery, a net, a web that once built was largely indestructible if possible. But the idea was is that when you died, your memories, your personality, a copy of it would be loaded into the phylactery, and the phylactery was live. So people who were in there, personalities that were in there, could communicate with each other and work on projects and crowdsource ideas. And as time went on, more and more got added in. I think most of the incarnations are in that net, always, you know, talking amongst each other and contacting the Twilight on the outside whenever, like, you know, you go to sleep or whatever, and you can delve on in and, like, you know, get opinions from your previous incarnations. The only people smart enough to really understand this project. The original idea for the full-scale version would be a addition to the Loom of Fate, a sort of cancerous installation that would allow the destiny of the Twilight to never cease, never stop, never break, never end. You know, make it immune to fate and destruction. So if the Twilight died, quote-unquote, as an extension to Dual Magnus Prana, they just show up somewhere else. They would always be alive. Time would reset for them, and they'd just be there. Like, they wouldn't go back in time. It would just be as if they never had died. Okay. This project was shelved somewhere along the line, and a second project was thought up. Again, an extension of the idea behind Dual Magnus Prana. So the idea was, after experimenting with Elsewhere and how Autochthonia escaped and how the different realities layer onto each other, was to build a machine, a safe that the Twilight could go into and have like time suspended for himself and push not Elsewhere, but somewhere further than Elsewhere, somewhere that was outside the constraints of the wild and all that stuff. And in creation, there would be sympathetic dolls, and the safe would connect to these dolls, and basically the Twilight would be there. The Twilight is there in creation. It's perfectly fine. It's undetectable. It's not like they're actually, you know, a doll or anything. But if the Twilight were to die, the fate of its death happens to the doll. So you just have like a robot left behind. And the Twilight's back in the safe. And always has been in the safe. Because it was just mirroring its destiny into creation.
Okay.
And then as long as there are dolls, and, you know, there always will be, the Twilight just keeps coming back over and over and over again. Forever. Never dying. And like the phylactery would get installed into there.
You mentioned that that's in Tesseract?
It might be. It's related to it. It's research related to it. That basically because the Majestic learned more about it in this incarnation, was able to apply it and finish the project.
I think in the Majestic's soul session, you mentioned that she could be in Tesseract. She could have some future vision, but then she'd be also exposed to
that. Exactly. Yeah. And that's why you want to stay away from that shit. Now, that project, too, was also scrapped for a better project. The ultimate solution to the dying problem. It's not about solar exaltation. It's not about reincarnating. It's about you right now always living. So the Twilight's final project, after studying the Loom of Fate and studying Elsewhere and studying how destiny works and the nature of Dual Magnus Prana and all that, was Project Game Master. The idea is, on calibration, the Loom of Fate shuts down to recalibrate itself. You know, calibration. So you sneak in, rip open the Games of Divinity, and install a module. And this module would be the Twilight. It would be everything about the Twilight's soul and personality and cognition. And it would just, like, put you into the Games of Divinity. So you'd be a function of the entire machine. You would be the machine's controller. You'd be the god of the machine, basically. And the point of this is that if you're the Games of Divinity, then the people who play the games are going to protect you forever. The Titans certainly did. The Unconquered Sun and Luna and the Maidens, they're not going to do anything to the games. They're not going to fuck with it. They're not going to destroy it. They're not going to try and ruin it. And of course, since you're in charge of running the Games of Divinity as the god of it, you can control how the games go. And as we all learned from the Dawncast, if you can control how people play or people learn, you can control how they think. So being the power or the intelligence behind the Games of Divinity would give the Twilight ultimate immortality, ultimate safety, and ultimate control over the biggest forces in creation by being able to subtly influence the mind of the Incarna playing it.
Well, I guess provided creation survived.
I mean, if it didn't, who would care then?
Primal Elves, maybe.
If they escape. Fuck them. They can't escape. They're imprisoned forever.
Gaia.
So that's the Twilight's project.
Yeah. So how has Majestic progressed in that?
Majestic found the prototype phylactery that has all the memories into it, and that's really the part that's important, because the one that would make you a fact of time or whatever just was abandoned. It just didn't work out. Mm-hmm. The Majestic finished Operation Safe, the absolute safety sphere, and is using it. If the Majestic were to ever die in the session, it would just be a doll. It's a permanent dual Magnus piranha.
Yeah.
It just hasn't come up yet.
Yeah, I wonder how it would come up or how we could try interacting with it, because, oh, it's nice that, yeah, Majestic is becoming immortal and so far, but if it never comes up, I don't know.
Right?
Yeah.
I think the Games of Divinity thing would be the big one. That would be the one that would require everyone's help, and that would be the one that it would have to, like, get you all involved in.
Yeah, it would be really... Well, it depends on how Nicole wants to play this out, but seeing that her character is a bit megalomaniacal, they would see...
And paranoid.
Yeah. They would see him trying to actually do this power and do influence, you know, the incarnate and so forth, and it would be interesting to see how it would go. Would we still continue with the character? Would we say, congratulations, Nicole, you won the game. Now make a new character, and this is the antagonist now. We'll see.
Maybe. I don't know. I'm not really about that, but we'll all see how that plays out.
So I guess it's the furthest along among all the other projects?
Hmm?
We say that it's the furthest along among all the other projects, or...?
Probably... Yeah, that's the first. She's the only character she's the only player that's pushed that project along.
Well, I guess you compare it to, you know, the Queen's project, sort of going advanced, but... Ah.
I think it's had the most influence in it so far. Like, it's had the most work done on it.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the Nightcast.
Oh, the Nightcast.
So the Nightcast, you're the second Nightcast in this game. The first one was an NPC that owned Nicole's character, the Majestic, and was murdered. And that guy was a skeezy bureaucratic merchant.
Was it murdered before the session even started? Or
yeah, it's back. It was backstory.
Okay. Interesting. Nobody else wanted to play the Knight.
No one wanted to play the Eclipse either. No. Except for that one guy, but he's gone.
I wanted to play the Eclipse, but it was taken, so I have to play the Knight now.
And now this has informed us, because it's an in-joke, actually. We used to game with this guy, and he played the original Nightcast, actually.
Uh-huh.
Way back up in the Arctic, right? And the shtick was that this was the first incarnation of the Majestic, who was like a Dawncast who used sights and magic tech. It was stupid.
Okay.
It was very rough. But the Countess was there too. This was the first version.
Yeah.
Anyway, so it was all about being him, like, you know, being Megatron-esque, you know, megalomaniacal and stuff. And when they were talking about their plans, the Nightcast, who had hired Nicole's character, was all like, whoa, I'm entitled to 50% of this. And the Nightcast was hiding that he was exalted. So he was like talking down to the Majestic and stuff and being shitty and stuff. And it was all like, well, technically you'll be paid what I allow you to take. And they were in the Majestic's manse and he was covered in orichalcum. And the Countess was there boosting his ego. And he was like, get the fuck out of here. And then he revealed that he was a solar and like tried to mind control the Countess and shit. And Nicole attacked and I think eventually killed him. And the dude didn't stop playing after that because he's like, this just isn't fun. It's like, you fucking... This was like the third time this guy had done something like this too, where he had built a character specifically there to cause problems for himself. Like, there's a D&D game where he played like an evil fighter or whatever, and that's fine. But the game had the concept of life insurance, and it was D&D. So the thing was is that you pay to the church, and the church does its damnedest to resurrect you if you die.
Uh-huh.
Right? So he met some goblins that had nothing to... They didn't want to do anything wrong. They didn't want to fuck with anyone. They were just trapped in this dungeon. They were trying to escape. And he described how he, like, murdered the leader and tortured him. And then, like, left him alive but not murdered and, like, cut out his limbs and eyes. So when the church checked to resurrect him and found that he was still alive, they wouldn't do it. And that would waste his life insurance. And I'm like, that's not how life insurance works. Like, you didn't even ask me how it worked. I just gave you a brief rundown. You didn't ask, like, you were like, okay, specifically this, this, and this. So eventually he'll die of his injuries and he'll get life insurance because it's fucking comprehensive and he'll be back and he'll be pissed. And he's like, oh, that just ruined this character. I've made big enemies. I'm like, you play stupid games, win stupid prizes.
Well, you know, it doesn't ruin their character. It just gives you different things to play now.
Yeah, but he was pissed off that he'd made a fucking mortal enemy because he did the not crime of torture and murder someone who was just trying to help his people escape a dungeon and hadn't actually done anything wrong. And he's talking about how they were considered sub-people and stuff. I'm like, but I told you in the setting, they're goblins are like beast people. They're just like orcs or like minotaurs or whatever.
Sub-people.
They're not sub-people. They're just different. People don't consider them vermin. Someone would actually be pretty pissed that you did this if you were in the right city, which you are. Anyway, he kept doing shit like this, and the Exalted thing was the last fucking straw, and we never saw or heard from him again. Like, I see his accounts online every once in a while, and they never come online at all, ever. It was like that moment he disappeared from the face of the earth. Oh. But the Nightcast, you know, being shitty and stupid and getting himself murdered because he was treating the Majestic like a slave, that worked itself into the Majestic's new backstory, where he was a slave, and the Nightcast was the master. And the Nightcast was hiding that he was exalted and was just working with the Killer Queen on the project, on the original expedition. And then the Majestic exalted, and the Nightcast was like, you're still my slave! And then the Majestic's like, what? No, I'm not. And then the Countess broke out of cryo freeze at that point, snuck up on the Nightcast, yeah, and put her hand through his fucking chest cavity and ripped out his still beating heart and fed it to the Majestic.
Well, you know, that's like two life, you know, boons owned, one for saving your life as a slave and one for helping you exalt.
My fucking Christ. Yeah, then you come along fucking 6 months later, and you're playing a mercantile Nightcast that loves slaves.
Yeah.
Loves slaves.
Well, you know, in earlier drafts, I think, oh, it'll be some ultra-capitalist. I'm like, that doesn't really work out with this party, and someone really hates slaves, so I have to adapt.
Everyone likes ultra-capitalism. They just don't like being fucking hypocrites, because they're always fucking hypocrites.
Yeah. I think my kind of moved beyond capitalism now. It's like, oh, I have so much money, I don't care.
It's not about capitalism, maybe. It's about power. So, yeah, the Nightcast's immortality plan was to always have a sort of bureaucratic organization on his side, to basically build a bureaucracy or build a cult that was a living entity in aggregate, mm-hmm. so that whenever he reincarnated, he would always have a support network there to pick him up and teach him everything he needs to know and give him the training and the tools he needs and his artifice and show him where his secrets are. And put them back together. So he custom, he being a thief, you know, being a Nightcast, being the perfect stealth character, stole the Fire of Exigence from the Unconquered Sun and made his own exaltations. And this group of Exigent that are based off the Al-Hassassins, like the original Assassins, uh-huh. They're kind of based off of that, but they're also like they're like business in nature and stuff. This organization that you personally trained and gave resources to and secrets and stuff and cachets around creation of these exalts that would keep, you know, receiving the power of the bureaucrat and would always pursue you in your next life to, like, make sure that you had a support network.
Yeah.
And all your secrets. That was his immortality. Because it didn't matter who he was when he exalted next as long as he had power. Yeah. Because power is power. Money isn't power. Yeah. Influence isn't power. Fucking friendship isn't power. Power is power.
That reminds me of a bureaucracy charm from, I think, Lands of Creation, the Dreams of Fortage.
Oh, no.
Yeah, the Legend Lives On, which basically you focus on some organization, and then when you die, your spirit sort of continues, and the organization continues as if guided by your hand. And when next time you reincarnate, the spirit sort of seeks you out, takes you in, teaches you everything you need to know, and then you become the leader of the organization and so on.
Cool. I actually didn't know about that.
Yeah. Well, yeah, you mentioned that the whole book was like so bad and unbalanced, so of those bureaucracy seven, essence seven charm and so on, that, yeah, didn't make much sense. But yeah, I was like looking through various bureaucracy charms out there for anything I could take in the Godbound and found this, and it seems to be related, basically, to this idea. So yeah, if I know about this project earlier, oh my, would I ever pursue it?
See, yeah. I have a clear memory in my head, listeners, of sitting here at this table, talking to Peter about it and explaining these immortality projects. And last fucking session, it was revealed that Peter had no goddamn clue what I was talking about.
Yeah, the only thing I heard about was, oh, the Majestic wants to, you know, put herself in the bubble in her own little off-topic. Okay, that sounds interesting.
You didn't realize that every single fucking one of you were crazy people and had your own little projects.
Well, didn't know anything about that. And probably I would have dug through all the archives from I Am that the Killer Queen grabbed, and probably would have started on that in my off-topic session, but yeah.
I mean, you're a Nightcast, and you were perfect in the first age, and you built a secret Illuminati shadow organization. It's not exactly going to make it into the scrapbook with a leaf and wax between the pages, really.
Some allusions to it, perhaps.
No, definitely. See, I thought you knew out of character. That's why I didn't make it obvious in the text, because I just assumed you'd start pursuing it.
No, I wouldn't know it, so I guess we'll just...
Uh-oh, SpaghettiOs.
Yeah. So, the gist of it. How do you steal the whole fire of exaltation for the unconquered sun?
Be a first-age solar that's better than you.
Jeez.
You didn't focus on stealth at all.
Yeah.
He did. He sweet-talked his way in, got right where the Unconquered Sun holds the Fire of Exigence. Maybe he fucking impersonated someone, too, and lied to the sun and got away with it. Was all like, thank you, Father, and took the exaltations. And did, and did this a few times to get more than one.
Yeah.
I think this is the implication here. Yeah. I think if we were to talk about what the event was, it wasn't just like sneaking into his room and stealing his fucking 8-track player out of his car. I think your character might have impersonated a god and like did the whole sob story and just fucking bold-faced lied to the sun a few times and stole your own exaltations.
Well, that would be really interesting to get into. I guess we'd have to sort of narrow down how the...
And then kept them hidden for the rest of the first age, so the Unconquered Sun never knew that you fucking robbed him.
Yeah, I guess it'll be really nice to figure out the mechanics of that, because, well, the whole exigence process has been really all that written out in the book, so we'd have to figure that out, but...
Exigence could be anything. They could be just an exaltation that is passed down through who's worthy. They can be an exaltation that's passed down by a god who, like, you know, stores them and, like, gives them out.
Yeah.
They can be an item like Thor's hammer or a morpher, like in Power Rangers. Those are examples of exaltations. They could be bloodline-related, like dragon-blooded. They could be like a bionic prosthetic or a parasite. Like, exigents are built to be the homebrew exaltation that are weird, man. So we have no idea what your fucking Illuminati exigents will even look like. Will they all be the same? Where did their power source come from? What's their portfolio? Because they're not gods of you. You stole it, and then you probably went to another god and like tricked him into giving you his power into the exaltation to catalyze it. Who can say?
Yeah, we'll have to definitely hash that out and work on it.
You have fucking nightingales from Skyrim out there.
Well, so yeah, basically there was no progress in that because I didn't know anything about it, and I guess everything's up for grabs for the next time we have any downtime, which might be never. But
it'll probably come up. I can see there being solo sessions coming.
Yeah,
like not immediately. We just got through a bunch, but they usually show up in the middle to last third of the season.
Yeah.
Even if they're not, you guys are going to be doing more stuff in between sessions through notes and stuff, and we might be doing a little more anthological sessions.
Yeah. Well, definitely be interesting to catch up on that.
Yeah. I'm going to pause. So I guess that leaves us with the last one, the Eclipse Cast. So, the Eclipse
I based off of the original origin story for Infernals because that was an okay idea, but I just made it, in my opinion, a little more interesting. In our game, we've divorced Infernals and Abyssals from being corrupted Solars because that idea cheapens all three in huge ways. So, and there's no thematic point in having an Infernal or an Abyssal be a Solar Spark that can just flip over because that's a really specific type of game that doesn't benefit anyone. So in our game, the Solar Exalts were murdered in the Usurpation. And when they were murdered, their Exaltations were locked away. Woo, into some place. Now, the death of the Solar Exalted was such a psychological scarring event that, and this happens in Creation, grave goods are usually made of things that are cherished and flip over into the Underworld. So there's an Underworld version of a thing that was left behind in Creation. So there's like a ghost copy. So when the Solar Exalts died and their Exaltations were sealed away, within the prison they were sealed in, you know, whether that was the stars or whether that was the ocean, they also had companion Exaltations that were grave goods, generated by the reverence and the despair and the memories people had of the Solar Exalts, a sort of Underworld version that got caught up in the trap. So the 300 Solars also had mirrored 300 abyss, dark Exaltation shards in there. When the Solars finally broke free, those dark Exaltation shards, or those Exaltations, immediately went to seek out new owners, but didn't really have any direction of their own, because they're memories, and they exist independently. It's not like they're a copy of each Solar. Like, there's no Dawn, there's no the Wanderer Abyssal version out there, there's just 300 distinct Abyssal shards now, or Abyssal Exaltations. I don't like using those. Always stupid. So the Death Lords, the Neverborn basically knew these things were around in their crazy, rambling, labyrinthine dreams and pushed the Death Lords into gathering them up, holding on to them, and then starting to give them out to Abyssals and stuff. And they, of course, missed, making Death Knights. And they missed a bunch that just went free on their own or were able to find suitable hosts and stuff. But Abyssals are grave good versions of Solar Exaltations. That is a thematic kind of idea. It doesn't go beyond that. Like, they don't disappear in sunlight. If the Solar dies, the Abyssal doesn't die. None of that fucking stupid shit. The core concept. They were so beloved that that a copy grave good was created that also got wrapped up in the cave. Now, Infernals. Let's get into that with the Eclipse cast. So in the first stage, in one of your first incarnations, there was the Primordial War, and you fucking jokers ate it at the death of a Primordial. He got murdered, and the Eclipse survived, and he had shell shock. But he noticed when one of the Primordials went through fetish death, it released some sort of insane Chthonian energy or whatever that was, not understood because it was so rare for a Primordial to go through fetish death. So he started researching this and found that there was a power inside of it. So he also went a little crazy from grief, so by the time you guys reincarnated, he had already had a plan together as the war raged on. And as the war raged on, he found another Primordial that they were fighting, and he fetish-deathed it. And when he did, he absorbed the power being released by the death of the Primordial. And as eclipses are, he's the bridge between all the different spirit and god and titan types. And he absorbed that power and turned his Solar Exaltation through what not well understood flaws in them into the first Titanic Exalt. A green sun, not even a green sun prince, a Titanic Exalt. They were called Titanics, and their other term was Warlock. They were exalts of the Titans. They were primordial. So he had powers based on the Primordials and was able to change his exaltation and change his body and become stronger and more steeped in sorcery and the laws of the universe because he was drawing power now from the creators of, creation. He started showing other exalts how to do this, how to flip and become warlocks, and they eventually were part of the Primordial War in destroying it, and they were part of the Neoborn Legion Wars that came after, the Aftershock Wars. But basically, the Eclipse cast was fucking insane and thought that the Unconquered Sun was a dickhole and thought that the Solar Deliberative couldn't stand as long as the Incarna lived and declared war against the Unconquered Sun and led the Warlock Rebellions. So all the Infernals and all the Solar and Lunar allies they had rose up against the Solar Deliberative in an attempt to try and, storm Yushan and murder the Incarna. And that got put down. That didn't work. So he was executed, and all the other Infernals were executed, or the Warlocks were. And Tok'vun and the Unconquered Sun patched that, so it could never happen again. Yeah. They fixed that. They really fixed that.
So is any of this related to the canon of Exalted, or is it just...
A little bit, actually. The Warlock Rebellions, and there's this guy called Thrice Damned Goral, which was the dude that did exactly what I talked about and was super mad that his people died and hated the sun. That was basically the Eclipse Cast's first incarnation. I've just changed what it means, because they weren't Infernal Exalts at that time. They were a different thing that was fixed that couldn't happen again. Now, this led the Yozis to understand that there were different ways to get power. And the Ebon Dragon and Cecilene, and she lives in her name, and Malphius and Azuran, they all started looking at this and started plotting. So their plan was to take the Solar Exaltations when they got freed from the prison they were in and turn them into Yozi Exalts. Rah! 300 Yozi Exalts who love Yozis. Now, of course, because the Yozis are failures and are losers and can't win because they've lost, their net to catch the Solar Exaltations didn't really work.
Okay.
So when the Solars got loose and the Yozis were like, and now we catch them, they did get stuck in the quote-unquote abstract metaphysical net, but the net only really captured the memories and past live experiences of all the Exaltations, and the Solars went and started exalting, but with really broken ideas of how their past worked. But those memories stayed behind, and those memories were of first-age Solars, pissed off, tyrannical, hateful, rock-star first-age Solars. So they had all these impressions, all these complete personalities of these first age tyrants. And I'm not going to lie, the Yozis really love tyrants. So, pissed off that their plan failed, they all kind of got an idea. And using the same process that a Talk Found in the Unconquered Sun used to like rip themselves up and diminish themselves and weaken themselves, I think they detonated a few of their third circle souls and pooled this power and wrapped it around each individual three of the 300 impressions, you know, the coin impressions left in the wax, and made their own exaltations that were like Solars, but, you know, had all those first age memories locked in, you know. That'll cause a lot of damage. These guys are tyrannical assholes who have the nuke codes, and they set them free into the world. I think the story with how Infernals, you know, have an unwoven coagitator and, like, you know, use demons as the delivery method for the exaltation and stuff, I think that's all still there. They just, you know, took all of their third circle souls and tore them apart and made a sort of vat that they just put the exaltations in and, like, made demons out of that they just sent out to find hosts. And I don't think they go back to the Yozis when they die. I think they just go and find another host or whatever. But that's what Infernal Exalted are. That's the legacy of the Eclipse Cast. He enabled this shit. You know, and maybe, just maybe, if you really wanted, there's a method for going back to being a warlock, which is different from what an Infernal is. You know, maybe the triumphant howl of the Devil Tiger, you know, the way where you turn yourself from an Infernal Exalt into your own primordial with your own world soul inside of your soul and your own third circle demons, maybe that secret's locked away inside the Eclipse Cast. Waiting to be rediscovered. Ultimate power. The bridge between the spirit world and the mortal realm, which is what the Eclipse is. His ultimate diplomatic bridge was finding a way to turn to something more than a Solar Exalt.
Yeah, I guess we just need to torture it out of his exaltation.
Yeah, torture it out of him. Make him hateful. I mean, nuking a few of those Yozi fetish souls might do the same trick. Or, you know, there are two or three primordials out there.
Yeah, still on the loose.
Gaia, Tokthon, Cytheria, Remethius, they're out there. I mean, a Tokthon's right there. His fetish soul's the core. It's super right there, just waiting.
Juicy for the taking.
Just like put Seawolf, rub his face next to it, smash it open, murder a Tokthon's fetish soul, and see him absorb the power and see if he can pick up on it again.
I don't think it'll go very well.
All right,
Seawolf, do something competent. Nope.
All right, a Tokthon, this is going to hurt once, but damn, is it going to hurt? So that was my idea. The Dawncast, I wanted to make a method of immortality that was intelligent for a cultured warrior, which is what a Dawncast is supposed to be. They're, you know, they're supposed to be like samurai or like the Klingons from the Undiscovered Country.
Like, what do you call those? Kaskrads? The perfect people that, you know, back in the Rome days, it, you know, when you were a warrior, it didn't. Or maybe those Greeks that, oh, you weren't just strong and you know, fast and so on. You also had to be cultured and smart and everything like that.
I know what you're talking about. I don't know the term.
I think it's called Kaskagat or something.
The concept of erite, you know, perfection in all
things.
Yeah, I thought that was great. It made the Dawn more than a big, dumb, stupid fighter who had, I don't know, the first thing that I think someone mentioned, like way back when I was spitballing this line somewhere, was some fucking sword that's eight souls and made you immortal. Fuck off. How does that encapsulate everything about a Dawn cast? Now, the next question is, how does the genealogy thing encapsulate the Zenith? Well, I'll tell you, asshole. The genealogy thing for the Zenith ties into zealotry, ferventness, cult building, worship, familial connections. These are all things a Zenith does. They build a community. They build relationships between people who have like that sort of ferventness in their hearts, and they turn it into a power. And that's all the Zenith did. That's all the Killer Queen did.
That reminds me a lot of how Egyptians were, that, oh, you had, you know, the gods were the pharaohs and so on, so they
embraced. Oh, yeah, that too.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Fucking Britain too, the European monarchs, all of it. The Zenith cast has gone full on weaponizing love. Weaponizing feelings and family and blood relatives. The Zenith cast embodies that, and so does the Killer Queen. So, boom, right in thematics. The Twilight cast, it's fairly obvious. Like, the first, it even follows the themes of an engineer, right? So, like, you know, an engineer has prototypes and stages. This is the only one that has stages to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, oh, I'm going to be forever by rewinding time. Oh, I'm going to be forever by putting myself in a perfect safety mech. Oh, I'm going to be forever by re-engineering reality itself and changing the nature of the Titans' plans. It's that slow build-up.
Yep.
That's perfect for an inventor, a lore master, and a master of the mind. The Nightcast, you stole fire from the gods, and then you built a shadowy Illuminati organization that only controls the government, the media, and the money, but also are so down on the level that even if they die, they just come back. And if you die, you just come back. You built yourself a little Illuminati that perpetuates itself. That's perfect. That's Night.
Yeah.
And the Eclipse is the weird one. Because in Godman, we don't have a mechanism for an Eclipse to learn out of cast charms. Like, you know, the Eclipse charm share power. Yeah. We don't have that because it's dumb. Yeah. But what the Eclipse does have is the ability to kind of... The Warlock thing where she turns his own exaltation into something completely different. That's like a perfect expression of the Eclipse's potential to be that bridge between all the different types of realities and be the diplomat and the sort of, what's the word? It starts with an A, ambassador. Mm-hmm. An ambassador between all these different powers. Well, this is the ultimate expression of that. Taking it a step further, not being an ambassador, not being a bridge, but taking that power and forging it into yourself and making you into the other. Because ambassadors and diplomats do that. They try to find common ground between two different sides. And the ultimate expression of finding ground between two different sides is going over to the other side and becoming the other side. And now there's only one side, and it's yours, and you're in charge. So all five of these are concrete ways to take the major thematics of the solar casts and the maximum potential for human ingenuity and human strength and turning it into something that will last forever, turning into the end of the road. And these are all things that are facts in the universe. These are all things you guys can pick up in any incarnation. If we played Exalted again with that same circle and you guys just switched the casts around, you could still peel these back up and start running with them again.
Oh, that's something interesting. So you mentioned that this was introduced in the first season?
Yep. Season one, I had the outline for all of these. They've gotten a little more ironed out since then. Like, I had the idea of the Nightcast stealing exaltations, but the bureaucracy side of it didn't really come up. And like it being an organization, it being like a secret Illuminati, didn't really materialize until you showed up and you started acting fucking exactly like the last Nightcast. And I'm like, there you go. Every one of these was colored by how the players are acting, because whenever the players are acting, I just backwards retconned that's how their prior incarnations were. So once the Killer Queen started stealing material for a super baby, I'm like, well, obviously this isn't a new thing. This isn't different. This is a huge, morally questionable thing that you're doing and you're absolutely certain you're right about. That's a lot of arrogance and hubris. This has to be something that you're known for. This terrible habit has to be ingrained in your memories somehow.
Mm-hmm.
The Majestic always wants to be safe. The Wanderer wants people to respect him and wants people to think that he's bigger than he is sometimes. Sometimes the Wanderer
really wants to be the one in charge and wants to be the coolest guy in the house. So this is the natural extension
He wants to take charge of like what's morally right, what's morally wrong. And so.
And you know what's great? If everyone agrees what's morally right and morally wrong, because everyone's like you. Everyone works out. Everyone lifts weights, bro. Everyone loves fist fighting and eating lots of food. Everyone wears karate gis. Everyone styles their hair the same way. And they all go to the same clubs and the same music and watch the same movies. So obviously that was what he was going for. A world where everybody knew just how cool him and his muscles were and were always oiling him and giving him tanning solution.
That sounds like Ledger.
Well, but, you know, that's your guys' cross to bear.
Yeah.
And, yeah, the eclipse. Every time someone hates Ian, Ian tries to worm his way out of it. He'd be like, hey, we're buddies. This is what you sound like, Ian. So I'm like, fine. What would be the per... It reminded me of World War Z.
Uh-huh.
Did you read the book?
No.
In the book World War Z, they introduce a concept called striplings, kiplings, shit, what were they called? Let me pause. Quislings. So the concept of a quisling in World War Z was that in a normal war, people either want to run away and hide, want to fight the opposing force, or they start to, like Stockholm Syndrome, empathize with the opposing force and betray their own people and become the opposing force. Because something big and scary trying to murder you with guns, it's easier to become them, and then they're not that scary anymore. Now they're a powerful thing protecting you.
Mm-hmm.
So in World War Z, people couldn't take the stress that not only did zombies exist, but they would never stop. They would never hold back. And if you didn't kill every single one of them, they would always be coming for you every second of every day of every year for the rest of their lives. This caused some people to adopt a super Stockholm syndrome and called quislings, where they just started acting like zombies. They would just start moving around and completely act like a zombie and like attack people and shit. And zombies aren't tricked by that stupid shit and would start ripping them apart as soon as they got within range. So all these reports of zombies turning on zombies were basically chalked up as the military's cure for zombieism or zombie repellent working and like, you know, making the zombie horde destroy itself. But it wasn't. It was the fucking quislings. It was people that were doing that. And it made people think the inoculations and the vaccines were safe, and they weren't.
So
this relates, to bring it back, this relates to Seawolf, because he's like that. Whenever someone too big and scary comes along, he tries to be their friend or tries to act like they've actually been allies all along and refuses to accept the reality that he has to do something about this asshole.
Well, he already starts thinking like a primal girl, it seems, that he cannot accept the reality and just replaces it with his own version.
Yeah, so, it's a little bit like Dr. Seuss. Do you ever see Grinch Night?
I'm not sure.
Grinch Night's cool. It's the Halloween version of The Grinch Stole Christmas. It's fucking crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But the kid, Ukariah, he has glasses, and he keeps talking about how he can see better without them, and his father's like, no, you can't, Ukariah. Don't be a dickhead. Wear your fucking glasses and face the facts that you wear glasses. And later on, he's talking to the Grinch, and the Grinch is trying to scare him to death. And he's like, what are you doing there? And he's like polishing his glasses. He's like, oh, I'm just polishing my glasses, but I see better without them. No, you don't, Ukariah. You have glasses. Just sit down and face the facts. Like, everyone was doing that to him every fucking time. And that just reminds me of Ian with the Seawolf.
Does sound like him.
It's a bit of a rag on him, but it's all in good fun because that leads to a much cooler backstory thing for his character. You know, this obsession with becoming like everyone else and not facing the facts that some people are just going to hate you, bro, turned his character into having the ability to become anything else he really wants to.
Oh, Seawolf, your character used to be so interested in the First Age. What changed?
You're a monster.
Yeah. Well, it's not bad in the right setting, I guess.
But. It turned into something cool, and it's based off a slight... It's based off a caricature of Ian. So it's okay.
Okay, I think that's a nice...
Yeah, that went an hour.
Yeah.
All right, so that is the talk about the First Age Incarnations. We talked a bit about the thematics behind it and why it led there. That's a good tool for people interested in lore about this game specifically, as opposed to greater Exalted lore.
Yep. And also good for the players so they can refer to it if they ever want to pursue those things like I do now.
Yeah, it blows my mind that you didn't know. Like, I have this clear memory of telling you, and it's shocking to me that I fucked up. I didn't.
Oh, well, we can fix that.
Yes. So, this is Devin.
And Peter.
From Sponsored by Nobody, signing off.
I believe our future. future depends powerfully on how well we understand this cosmos, in which we float like a mote of dust in the morning sky.